The Guardian.
Mark Miodovnik is a materials scientist by training, but his career at UCL's Institute of Making is about as far from the lab scientist stereotype as you can get.
One day we had some artists walk in and they started licking the samples. And I was like, oh, don't lick the samples.
He's also an award-winning author. His book, Stuff Matters, won the 2014 Royal Society Book Prize, and he's presented numerous programmes for TV and radio. In this episode, we spoke to Mark about his time working at a nuclear weapons laboratory, about the traumatic experience as a teenager that sparked his interest in materials, and the challenges of making robotic trousers.
That means that the materials involved have to be both technical and they have to be wonderful, you know, to the touch. And I think that's the kind of project that we do really well.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Do I sound really
slow? Sat down with Mark in the studio recently.
I'm Mark Miodovnik. I'm Professor of Materials and Society at UCL.
During our conversation, we spoke about his life and his work, but to start with, I asked him to cast his overactive mind back to the formative years. The first thing I wanted to ask is, I'm always interested in whether scientists were geeky as children and whether you did any sort of experiments or made sort of collections of objects and things like that.
I think geeky is the right word to describe me as a kid. I mean, I had three older brothers. I still have three older brothers. And they took the roles in life of kind of, you know, raconteur and sportsman. Well, they're all boys, yeah. And then and kind of, you know, businessman. And then I was the kind of geeky academic one.
And what sparked off your interest in materials? Was that something that you were interested in early on or was it later?
So when I was 15, I was coming home from school, was waiting on Hammersmith Station, and this guy came up to me and he's, you know, I could tell immediately, you know, you can when you've lived in the city a long time, that it was no good. And he sort of pressed me against the wall and he said, you know, he wanted my wallet. And he said he's got a knife. And I looked down and he had his hands in his anorak pocket. And I was thinking, there's sort of pointy thing in there, but I thought he must be probably joking. And then my train came in. So I thought I just sort of pushed past him and just got onto the train. I thought that would be enough anyway. But then I felt this really, really intense pain down my back. And I thought, oh no, he's obviously, he did have a knife and he's cut my school blades and mum's going to be furious. And she's going to think, she's going to be just, you know, because I was always essentially ruining my school gear or losing it. So then I sat down, went home. And then as I got up, I looked back at the seat because it had kind of prickled and been painful. And I wondered how bad it was. Anyway, the seat was bright red. I realized I was in trouble. Anyway, cut a long story short, which is a pretty traumatic story. In the end, I went to the police and they caught the guy and we found that it was actually not a knife. It was a razor blade wrapped in tape. And I remember seeing it. I remember really clearly seeing it and seeing how sharp that blade was. And I really thought, that's incredible. Something just like the size of a stamp can do that much damage to me. I had 13 stitches in the end. What is it about stuff? Anyway, so then I started to really get into it.
That's quite an unusual reaction to being stabbed.
Well, as I said, I was geeky as a kid.
What did you study at university? Because materials kind of falls between a few different subjects.
Yes. I mean, I studied material science at Oxford, and there are a number of material science courses throughout the UK and worldwide. It seems like a sort of hybrid subject until you realise that the whole world is made of stuff. That's what we've been doing for thousands of years. The ages of civilization are named after stuff, you know, Stone Age, Bronze Age. And so it's kind of, it's the study of the world and the science behind how we make everything. So it obviously crosses over with engineering and it crosses over with physics and it crosses over with chemistry and it crosses over with biology and it crosses over with art and architecture and anthropology. In fact, it's the sort of nexus of all of those subjects. It's the more fundamental than any of them. If you're thinking about humans anyway. So, no, yeah, it does seem an unusual subject, but then when you think it through, you realise it's the best.
I discovered this next thing when I was preparing for this. This is something I didn't know about you and was surprised about. One of your first jobs out of university was working at a nuclear weapons laboratory. What was that like and what drew you to go and work there in the first place?
I did a PhD at Oxford in jet engine alloys, and I got quite expert in understanding the internal structures of metals at high temperature and high stresses. And then after finishing that, I looked for jobs, and I got offered this job at Sandia National Labs in America, which is the place where they make the rocket that send the nuclear, it's the thing that gets the bomb to the place it's going to go. And Los Alamos, which is just up the road in New Mexico, is the place where they make the actual bombs themselves. So, and I got offered this job, and it was, they were like, you're British, so you can't do anything on the actual high security stuff, but what we need is to understand materials better, because we're not allowed to test any of these things anymore. But they existing makes no sense unless they are viable. So we need to know, we need to sort of predict if they're viable, and of course they are viable now, but how long they'll be viable for, which bits of it we need to swap out. And that's not just the actual fission material, but it's also all the electronic circuits. So that was the job, is to try and understand how something as complex as a nuclear bomb sitting in a silo for 50 years, what's happened to it, and will it work?
So if a nuclear bomb got launched tomorrow, would you have contributed in a small way to it working?
I mean, I think anyone who works at those places is part of it. Yeah, for sure. So then I'm part of that. And I don't, you know, how do I feel about that? I'm not so happy that nuclear weapons exist, but since they do, I think they're part of our defense. Well, they clearly are part of our defense, especially in the current circumstances now, with Russia having become much more of a foe of the UK and the West, let's say. And you start to realize that defense is important. And, you know, I'm not someone who likes war, but I'm also not someone who wants us to be defenseless. So I feel in a nuanced position about it, but I don't feel bad about having done that work. I feel that it's important that we have good military and weapons that work for our defense. I suppose that's the point, isn't it? Is that it's for our defense, it's not to attack.
What made you leave that field of work?
It's in a desert. Living in a desert was an amazing experience. It's like, I mean, that particular desert in New Mexico is a mile high. It's an incredible place to wake up in the morning. It's blue skies every day. It's just desert as far as you can see. It's and then you go into work and you've got this incredible equipment and you're doing these very fine experiments, and it's really like living on another planet, honestly. That's how it felt to me. And I after a while I felt I had to return to planet Earth to the humans that I knew and loved. And for me, the life of the kind of isolated scientist living a very extraordinary but kind of very, very odd life, I just couldn't quite hack it.
It also sounds very different from the type of work you're doing now, in that I can imagine in that kind of lab you're really focused on quite niche problems around the properties of metals or nuclear materials, whereas your career since then has hugely broadened out. I think, was that another reason why you wanted to make a jump?
I think, you know, in retrospect, probably yes, but I didn't know it at the time. You know, in life when you think, oh, something's missing here, I this is not quite doing it for me. And then when later on in life, like now, 20 years later, I'm very happy with the kind of work that I do. And I, you know, and it is very much about people and culture and how materials are in people's lives and represent, not, don't solve technical problems, but also, also aesthetic and beautiful and wonderful to touch. And I think that stuff was sort of calling me at the time, but I didn't quite know it.
So your current title is Professor of Materials and Society. Could you just tell me a bit more about what that means and how you describe your job today?
Yeah, materials, I mean, is the stuff of everything, right? Take it away and we're naked on a very stony, bleak planet. So, I mean, it's the stuff we've made, all of this stuff around us. And and that's the scope of my job title, which is quite broad, as you might imagine. And I know a lot about the very niche aspects of metals and high temperature alloys. And I wanted to make sure that that kind of technology, that kind of really detailed knowledge about metals, was available to architects who were designing our buildings. Because it seemed to me, when I started this job, that, you know, actually a lot of high tech stuff gets poured into aerospace and telecoms, and we see the fruits of it in smartphones and, you know, holidays and airplanes, all these things. But I was worried, and I still am today, that actually we ignore the architecture and we ignore design, and that actually the arts side of materials, if you like, the culture, the fashion side of it, is quite separate from the technology engineering side of it. And that, to me, is really dangerous for a start. You get this kind of split of driving forces in society, and technology will lead us. And I think this is a lot of the worries about AI and robotics are partly because that stuff is starting to flourish, and it's in isolation, led by people who've only an education in engineering, who are not thinking about and don't have an education in human interaction with materials, what materials are in other ways, in other aspects of our lives. They're nurturing, and they're an expression of our culture and our history. And it sounds grandiose, but my job is to bring those two disparate types of materials research together and to let them benefit from each other. So let robotics, for instance, and telecoms benefit from the arts and humanities, and also let the arts and humanities benefit from the knowledge we have in material science. And I think there's just so much to be done in this field. I really feel like we're just scratching the surface now.
Mark is well known for his collaborations with non-scientists. But I was interested in whether these interactions are genuinely two-way streets. What can a material scientist learn from an artist?
I mean, that's the thing about a good collaboration, is that it's on equal terms, and that both parties, or more than one party, all get something out of the collaboration. Otherwise, it's not a collaboration. Otherwise, it's kind of an abusive relationship, really, isn't it? And I think that there are a lot of those around in the art science world. So I've really tried to, and I've learned lessons trying to get those things to happen, making sure both parties have something to get out of it. You might say, well, what can science, material science in particular, learn from the arts? Well, actually, lots of things. One is about complexity. That's something I've really, I have lots of people in my team, by the way, who are artists and designers, and I employ them. Why? Because they understand complexity. They've had an education about dealing with complexity, which I think actually is lacking in science and engineering. We've been addicted to reductionism, and that's brought a lot of benefits. It's brought understanding the periodic table, and we understand all the different elements, and we understand the protons and neutrons and electrons, and we've really taken the world apart. But I think we're not so good at putting it back together again and understanding how a complex system works for everyone, like not just delivers, you know, good performance in one area, but actually can allow, you know, people to enjoy it and to feel that it's part of them and their culture. And I think that bit, understanding humans and how humans interact with technology, and therefore designing materials that people will love in their lives and bring into their lives voluntarily, that is what the arts bring hugely to material science. Because you only have to look around you. The stuff that survives, the stuff that ends up being, you know, part of business and industry, and therefore, you know, allowing us to be wealthy, is the stuff people love, right? It's an emotional aspect of materials, it's not just their functional form.
Could I have an example of a collaboration that's worked really well?
One of the things that we've done at the Institute of Making, which is where I work and I built this team, is we built a library of materials. So we got thousands of samples of different materials, some of them crazy, mad materials, and some of them quite mundane, you might consider mundane, like glass and silk and so on. And one day we had some artists walk in and they started licking the samples, and I was like, oh, don't lick the samples, because, like, I health and safety, I can't you might get ill. There's bismuth over there, for instance. And they said, but they all taste so different, why do they taste so different? And I was like, well, I don't know, that's probably well known, I don't know the answer, but if you stop licking, I will find that out. And then I go away, they stop licking, I go away and research. I find out actually no one's really done any systematic work on why different materials taste different from each other. And so then we started a project in looking at the taste of materials. And in order to understand that, of course, you have to understand that taste is not just the chemistry of the material in its interaction with your taste buds. It actually reacts inside your mouth, that's true. But also it's your expectation of the experience that actually is a big part of the experience itself, and the history of having that material in your mouth, or what you think it will be in your mouth, the color of it, and also your cultural background. So we did this whole study involving artists, designers, psychologists, material scientists, chemists, and we discovered new science. So that was brilliant. We discovered some really new science about different metals and why they taste different than woods and plastics. But we also discovered you can modulate taste in really interesting ways with inanimate objects. And we produced a whole set of spoons, which we then worked with a Michelin star chef to design food that would taste only the way they wanted to taste it. If you had a particular material for the spoon, like a copper spoon would be paired with a prawn curry and the zinc spoon with the strawberry parfait. And that project had it all for me. You know, it was really why we were doing this. It's like, you know, that is true of almost all materials. They're part of our lives, and we experience them because we're humans essentially. But also they do have physical properties. They are made of, you know, elements, and we can understand that way. And it brought it all together, and I was, you know, I'm really proud of that project. And it's carried on going. So I've given talks about this, and some medics came up to me afterwards and said, do you know that taste malfunction is often a predictor of disease and can be very sensitive? It can be the first symptom. And if we had a taste test, a standardized taste test, then you could be predicting certain types of, let's say, even cancers early on. And then we start thinking about this from a design perspective. You have to taste your test every day. Like, so that's either washing your teeth. So could you design a toothpaste or a toothbrush which somehow tasted very distinctly, and that if you started to change its taste, you'd know you were ill? And so you see that, you know, that project in itself is an interesting juxtaposition of design and chemistry materials.
After this short break, we'll hear how you go about cataloguing a library of thousands of materials and what we should be doing about the particular material that's become public enemy number one.
The answer is not to get rid of plastics. Plastics are an expression of human modernity in lots of ways. Anyone tells you that there's a simple way of solving this is selling you something.
Plus, we'll hear a bit about Mark's new book on liquids.
It's really struck me clearly that liquids have this dual role in our lives, that they're both really dangerous and just really wonderful and powerful. And that's what the book's about.
We'll be right back.
Last year, The Guardian tracked all the deaths of young people due to knife crime and explored the themes that emerged in an award-winning series called Beyond the Blade.
Why are they carrying a knife in an area where they know people but they feel that they have to acquit themselves from other people?
We saw many people suffering, but we also saw many fighting back.
We've got to start looking at how we talk and how we generalise and how we categorise just ordinary people that are poorer than other people, or people who don't have as much as other people.
For this new series, journalists from The Guardian travel to Bristol, Birmingham and Croydon in South London to listen to some of those people.
Society tends to look down at young people once they've made a wrong choice, and what we're saying by that is that we're writing them off.
And rather than report on their conversations, we let them speak for themselves.
When I come out of jail, I'd never been praised before I'd turned my life around. And when I come out and got praised for the work that I was doing, I thrived. How are you?
That gap needs to be built up a bit sooner, you know, as opposed to, yeah, just waiting to hear from me, because I'm waiting to hear from the next generation as well. So we're all waiting and there's no, like, action happening.
If families are fractured, that has an impact on a young person. If a father and a mother get divorced, that has an impact on our young people. And I think the only way they know how to make people sit up and say, listen, there's a real problem going on here, is by violence.
To listen to all three episodes, head over to theguardian.com/podcast or subscribe by searching Beyond the Blade on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from Mark Miodovnik about the traumatic experience that inspired his lifelong fascination with materials. We also heard about his desire to collaborate, not just with other scientists, but with artists too. One thing I was keen to know more about was this materials library at UCL.
Could you just tell me a bit more about the materials library and why it was set up and what it's used for day to day?
When I first started trying to move from work with aerospace companies and telecom companies and try and understand what artists and designers and architects would need from a material scientist working with them, I found it very difficult to communicate. I was talking about equations and I constantly got graphs out and pointed at them and they just looked blank. And then I said, no, this is what I mean about that property. And I'd take a sample of material and I'd go, I get what you mean now. And I realized that it's the samples and the actual materials themselves that are a translation tool between the arts and the sciences. And that if I could say, put stuff in their hands and say, this is the kind of material I think we should be developing together for that building or that object, then we were suddenly away. And they were like, oh no, it should be like this and like that. And they would bring materials. And I realized that what you need is a library of materials that is this place where you can boil up new projects. And actually, as it has grown, started out with 100 samples, then it quite quickly went to 1,000, and now we're into the thousands. It's got more and more effective at doing that. And you can imagine we've got, now hundreds of projects have boiled out of that space. And it's just a marvellous, marvellous place.
How is it indexed? Is it according to the chemistry or according to how silky it is? Or,
well, this is going to sound bad, okay, but it's not indexed. What happens is every object has a number, but we don't put a label on it, because what we think is if you put a label on it, people immediately go, that's lead. I'm not interested in lead. When in fact, they might be interested in it. They just don't know yet. And in not being able to identify something, you get people's curiosity and you make them have to pick it up. And that's what we want. It's not a museum. It's a library. It's a place to work. It's just like a library of books, which is a place to work. This is a library. But of course, you're right. How do we arrange it all? And it constantly moves. It's like an animal, which can be quite disturbing and confusing.
Are there some projects there that you're particularly excited about at the moment?
Yes, I think there's two big areas of project area that I'm really excited. One is assistive technology. This is an area which is got to grow in size and is all about materials. And it's all about the crossover between the sensual side of materials and the aesthetic side of materials and their technical properties. And I'll give you an example. So we went to some people in wheelchairs and we said to them, how can we help you? Can we make a better wheelchair? And they said, no, I don't want a better wheelchair. I want to walk. And not only do we want to walk, but we want to walk and look normal. And so what we proposed to them was a garment that they would wear that would help them walk, that would assist them in walking. And it would be mechanical, but also a fabric. And it would transition between the fabric and a mechanical stiff support. And that material doesn't exist at the moment. But if we can invent that material, and we've been working on this for many years now, then we can actually open up opportunities for millions of people worldwide, but not just people who are sort of disabled due to, disease or unfortunate accident, but for everyone. We all get old. We all become essentially less able. So it's so important, this. But we're not going to forget along the way, and we haven't done any of this work without remembering that they want to look normal. So this thing has to be comfortable. It has to be sensual. It has to be loved as a garment, right? And that means that the materials involved have to be both technical and they have to be wonderful, to the touch. And I think that's the kind of project that we do really well and I think is the future.
How does such a garment actually work, and how far along are you with, producing this kind of robotic walking trousers?
Yeah, so the idea is that we would 3D print fabric. So you might think that fabric is, in your head, you might think of it as objects, but you can 3D print fabric with moving links. And in fact, think of this fabric as chain mail. So each link is separate from the next, but they intercalate and they're flexible. So imagine that around your knee, let's say, which is weak. And now we put actuators, so-called, inside that material. We print them. And so each link can be controlled and it'll lock or unlock, depending on our electrical impulse. So now you have thousands of little links, all controllable. And so now you want to put some weight on your knee. They all lock up, so they can support your knee. And now you want to move the other knee, so you want that knee to flex up. So you want all of those links to suddenly become relaxed, and it becomes flexible. So that's the mechanical bit of it. But then we need to get those connections in there. So that's getting an electrical connection to each link. That's not easy. We're working on that. Also, we need feedback. We need to know it's worked. So all mechanical systems like this need a feedback. So we need sensors. We need to know that the knee has moved. We need to know there's an electrical impulse from your muscles that you want to move. And that we're also working on. And those materials have to be both soft in one configuration and stiff in another. It's not easy. But actually 3D printing and these microfabrication techniques are just going on so fast now. And this area called soft robotics and flexible sensors is a big, big area in material science. The other area that we're really growing at the moment is research into plastics. And I feel very strongly that, you know, this unfolding environmental disaster is something that we have to own as a community. It's our problem. We're material scientists. You know, we invented these materials. People love them to the extent that they have them all throughout their lives. They wear them on their feet. You know, it's the tires of our cars, our bikes. It's in our homes. It brings the water in. It's the mobile phone. You know, it's everything. And yet we haven't thought about the end of life of plastics. And we need to do that now. And I really, really strongly feel that the whole material science community needs to get on board solving this problem, because the answer is not to get rid of plastics. Plastics are an expression of human modernity in lots of ways. You know, the comfort of our sofas, the fact that haven't got a lot of food waste because we've got incredibly good packaging materials is a triumph. What's terrible is that what we do afterwards with those plastics, but that is also solvable, but we must really work on it. And that's a big area of growth for us now.
And I did want to ask, are there good alternatives to plastics, or is it more about finding ways to reuse things?
There are alternatives to plastics, but I think it's a very nuanced, complex problem. Anyone tells you that there's a simple way of solving this is selling you something and hasn't thought it through. Even if you think about something as simple as that thin plastic covering over your tomatoes or your cucumber, and you think, does a cucumber really need a plastic sleeve? Well, it lasts, up to 5 times longer in that plastic sleeve. Now, if that means that you have 5 times as much waste for that item of fruit, and that goes with all the fruit and veg, what that is embodied is a whole load of CO2 emissions that were put into the fruit and veg and all the transport costs. So, and that's massive. That's a significant problem. So if you get rid of this very thin, lightweight material that brings the food into our homes in a very good state, you've got to replace it with something. And then you might say, let's just make it biodegradable. But the thing about that is we don't have very good ways of biodegrading stuff in a controlled way at the moment. And if you just say, biodegrade, it's fine, we can just throw it away. If it ends up in the ocean, it won't biodegrade. The temperature's too low. It'll stay there for 100 years. So, there are no simple solutions here. And it's a systems change. And we will have to get rid of some plastics, that's for sure. But mostly we'll have to really think deeply as a society about how to use this wonderful material well.
For a material scientist, Mark is unusual. Whereas in my head, a material scientist would be someone focusing on the minutiae of a new type of concrete, Mark's got an eye on the big picture. He's just as interested in the social and historical context that materials inhabit. In his new book, Mark takes a similarly broad approach to looking at liquids and how they permeate every aspect of our lives.
I'm working on this project called Self-Repairing Cities, and for the first time understanding tar on the road and trying to get roads to heal themselves. And I found out that tar, I should have known this, isn't a solid, it's a liquid, and that the road is full of liquid. And it just amazed me that there were so many things that we think of as solids that are actually liquids in our lives. And it got me thinking about, the liquid side is like the kind of, it's the sister-brother relationship between solid and liquid. And they're kind of one side of, they're both different sides of the same coin, aren't they? But liquids are sort of inscrutable, aren't they? And I was trying to get at what they really mean to us. With materials, I wrote a book called Stuff Matters, and it's really about how we've expressed ourselves as civilization through stuff, and it's all around us. And that seems to me obvious and an important concept. But what do liquids mean to us? And what role do they play in our lives? And that's what the book's about. liquids are very different from solids. I mean, they're not trustworthy. I mean, that whole thing about, you know, that's solid stuff and you can trust it. You know, there's a lot of truth in that. Liquids are constantly seeping and leaking and corroding and or killing us through hurricanes or floods or tsunamis or we die ourselves from blood loss or, you know, it's like, you know, it's just all this stuff. And yet they're so powerful. They're so important to us. We love to go into the bathrooms and drench ourselves with water. This is our preferable way of cleaning ourselves. and then in that bathroom, there's tons of liquid soaps and then we put liquid perfume on it, you know. And so it's really struck me clearly that liquids have this dual role in our lives, that they're both really dangerous and just really wonderful and powerful. And that's what the book's about, this dichotomy.
It's interesting because when you think of materials, certainly for most people, I think solid materials would jump to mind. And so I'm interested in whether liquids falls within traditional material science and whether there are many material scientists out there who are purely studying liquids.
There are many, many material scientists studying liquids, because to get to a solid, you often have to have a liquid. So, for instance, most metals go through a liquid stage, and understanding that liquid stage so it solidifies, you know, in a steel works or looking at a jet engine alloy, that's what I did my PhD on. The liquid stage is so important. So yes, you have to understand liquids to understand the solids and how to get there. But even today's most advanced technology, 3D printing, most of those technologies are a liquid. So essentially what you do is you take a plastic, you melt it and you put it on, and you have to understand how it turns into a liquid and then back into a solid again. So liquid, solid, that's the bread and butter of material science.
You've done throughout your career, you've done loads of outreach stuff. You've, you know, done telly and science festivals and been awarded all sorts of accolades for that work. I'm interested in whether that's kind of respected from within inside the community and whether science is getting better at celebrating the achievements of people outside of the lab.
Yeah, there's been a huge, I mean, when I started doing outreach about 10 years ago, I remember my head of department bringing me into the office and saying, just don't do this. You're a young academic, you've got a lot of promise, just don't waste it. You know, all the time you're spending doing that, you could be publishing papers, and that's what you should do. And I remember that really clearly. And that's only 10 years ago, but that was completely normal throughout the whole of science. And I ignored him because I, at the time, realized I couldn't get bright young British people to come into my lab. They didn't think it was something for them, and that really distressed me. And when I really thought why that was true, I thought it's because they don't think that doing a PhD in material science is cool and interesting and part of culture and vibrant thing to do with their lives. And that really, really got me depressed. I thought, I don't want to spend 30 years of my life with that attitude, which society represented that attitude. And the only way to do anything about it is to get out there. To get out there and talk to people about what you do and why you love it. And that's what I've been doing for 10 years. And in the meantime, loads of other people have been doing it too. And the whole of science has suddenly woken up to this fact that if they want public funding and they want politicians to listen to them and they want people to come into our labs who are really bright, the brightest of the bright, and not go into, let's say, banking and not go into, let's say, you know, being novelists, which are great things to do, but, you know, there are very bright people out there, and we want the brightest of the bright coming into science and engineering. And to do that, you've got to be in the public telling, you know, having this discourse with the public about why this is such an important topic.
Special thanks to Mark for joining us this week. We'll include a link to the Institute of Making and Mark's new book, Liquid, in the episode's description on the Guardian website. If you've got something to say, give us a shout on scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.